Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Welcome back, Sharkies, to Sharkpedia. We are so excited to have Christian Parton with us this week. Christian, would you like to go ahead and introduce yourself to our Sharkies?
Yeah, hi, everyone. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. I'm Christian Parton. I'm an early career marine biologist slash shark researcher. My research generally in the past has focused on the impact of plastic pollution on sharks, both from a kind of global perspective and then a local perspective here in the UK, namely via sort of entanglement in marine debris and then also ingestion of microplastics as well. But my kind of research has started to move slightly away from that as I'm kind of venturing forwards in my career. So I've got a few little different projects that I'm working on now, but my main research has generally revolved around those two issues.
Super cool. Well, we are very excited to have you. We're going to go ahead and jump right in. Megan, would you like to let everyone know what paper we reviewed and then give us a summary?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Christian mentioned, one of the things that he talks or works a lot with is entanglement. And that's the paper that we're going to talk about today that Christian published. And that article is called Global Review of Sharks and Ray Entanglement and Anthropogenic Marine Debris. So the summary for this article is that this paper is a literature review of susceptibility of cartilaginous fishes, which include elasmobranchs, so sharks, rays, skates, and chimeras, getting entangled in anthropogenic marine debris. The purpose of this article was to collect more data on exactly how susceptible elasmobranchs are to marine debris, which families might be most at risk, and determine which marine debris pose a higher risk for elasmobranchs to actually get entangled in. And this review article, on top of performing a comprehensive literature review of previous papers, their authors also collected data from Twitter, which I'm super interested to talk to you about. They found that ghost fishing gear was the most common marine debris that species were entangled in the Pacific Ocean, and they had the highest level of entanglement in the Pacific Ocean, and that while ghost fishing is a threat, it is likely far less of a threat than direct and indirect takes in marine fisheries, which we'll also chat about. Overall, the highlight is the need for scientific data on the subject and an urge for future research because there's not a ton of information about entanglement, which we'll get into. So before we dive in deep into like what all of this is and what species are really at threat, this is actually our first article that we're doing on the podcast that's a literature review, and that's not something that we've done in the past. It might be really interesting for our listeners to know, like, what's the difference with, you know, a different type of article versus this review that you've done?
So I think sort of a lot of early career researchers generally do, maybe for their sort of undergraduate dissertation, might do a small literature review. And basically, kind of to summarize it briefly, it's just a collection of all the existing literature that's out there on a specific topic. So in this entanglement paper, we made sure that it was a systematic literature review, which means it's repeatable. So anyone can repeat what we did instead of just kind of, you know, going through the literature randomly and finding all different bits and bobs. There's a methodology to it. So we went through and searched systematically to make sure that it was repeatable. And those methods are repeatable for kind of any topic that you want to do in any science, really. So that systematic part was kind of quite interesting to do. It's definitely very different to how a normal research paper might be written. Kind of there's no experiment that you're doing or anything like that. So it's generally a lot of reading and a lot of kind of scrolling down pages.
Yeah, but it's so important because I think one of the things that can sometimes get lost in science is you publish it and that's it and no one does anything with it. And I think literature reviews can be so important because it's like, we're not just letting these publications go out into the world and just sit there for, you know, just to sit on a shelf. You take it and you start to make connections with other publications and build kind of a broader perspective and broader picture of a bigger issue than just maybe one issue that might be thoroughly discussed in a single paper.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And they can help scientists sort of identify knowledge gaps. And that's one of the really, really important parts of science, is that we need to know what we don't know. And by doing a systematic literature review, or, you know, any literature review, really, that helps us identify those knowledge gaps. And then we can really start to look into that deeper. And then you start getting into the sort of experimental stuff, the modeling, all that kind of stuff. So they're really, really helpful pieces of research to write for the whole scientific community.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this article talked a lot about entanglement, right? And the whole point was that I also want to touch on briefly is, like, a literature review is a great place to go and get, like, a holistic view of a species, a problem, a topic. And they're really great kind of, like, base papers, especially for grad students to read, because you can find things like what the species eat, where they live, what their ecology is like, what their life history is. And the same thing goes for topics like entanglement. It's a nice place to see, like, what is entanglement? What are the things that we're worried about with it? Where do species get, or where are they most likely to get entanglement? Entangled. And so I definitely really enjoyed that part of this paper, because I have read, like, plenty of separate papers that have to do with entanglement, regular fisheries and things like that. But having, like, a paper that you can actually go to and read a whole thing about was very interesting to me. So for our readers, could you just explain what ghost fishing is for the audience? Because I think that's a term that a lot of marine scientists know, but probably not a lot of people who don't specialize in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, broadly speaking, ghost fishing can kind of be defined as when fishers potentially lose or abandon their gear, and that gear is then lost into the water and kind of floats around indiscriminately catching various different marine organisms over time. You know, the nets start to get full of animals. The nets then sink to the bottom, and then those animals are fed on by scavengers, and eventually the sort of, you know, the animals and organisms decay. And then, because obviously the nets generally are made of plastic materials, these don't degrade, and so they become lighter again, float back up to the surface, and the whole cycle just continues. And so it's just this repeated cycle of indiscriminate catching of various marine organisms, from, you know, fish species, marine reptiles, marine mammals, and then also sharks and rays as well.
Yeah. And in your paper, you kind of make a distinction between the two categories of debris that elasmobranchs and obviously any other species in the ocean can become entangled with or interact with. And you split these into fishing-based sources and land-based sources. Could you just kind of give some examples of how those are separate of each other, even if they overlap once they're in the ocean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, generally, your fishing-based sources of debris are things like nets and ropes, various different, you know, materials like that that are being used by fishers around the world. And then when you look at the more land-based items of debris, that would be things that are kind of generally used by people on an everyday basis. So, for example, polypropylene strapping bands or packing straps, which are basically used to sort of tie down, you know, pallets and various things that are being transported. So this is a land-based item that perhaps has, you know, ended up on a ship that's kind of moving, and then for some reason that's become detached and it's gone into the sea. Then other things, like, for example, if you were to buy a six-pack can of beer, that might have sort of plastic rings that keep those beers together. So that's another source of land-based debris that eventually might end up in the ocean kind of via poor waste management or something like that. So the two sort of categories are very, very separate. And in the research, definitely it kind of leaned more towards one of them, which I'm sure we'll go on to discuss in a second, but it was definitely more commonly the fishing based debris as opposed to the land debris. But that's not to say that the land debris isn't a problem, because it still is.
Yeah. And I think you brought up a really good point that I'm glad that you said, which is, you know, things like beer cans. A lot of people I've interacted with are like, well, I recycle and I put it in the garbage can, so my practices don't, like, impact the oceans. And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there by saying, you know, it's not just, you can do whatever you want with your waste, but waste management is a totally different beast. It's a different animal. Sometimes garbage is transported via a barge or something like that. So you might do it correctly. You might put it in the right place. But how we do, how we manage that waste as a country or a world is not perfect. And so waste does end up in the ocean even if you're being absolutely perfect with how you handle your individual waste. So that's why it's really good to limit that as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. As well, I think, you know, sometimes when people hear, well, okay, it was the fishing debris that was kind of more of the problem, so that's not my responsibility. But we were finding entanglement reports from land-based debris, some really quite strange items. So, you know, one of the sharks was entangled in a car tire. Another shark was entangled in some scuba diving, like regulator hose. You know, there are items that we are using as humans that are entangling the sharks. So, you know, obviously I know not a lot of people use scuba diving hoses. You know, a lot of people drive, you know, so the car could be coming from humans, but things like the 6-pack can of beer, you know, we do have a responsibility as consumers to think twice perhaps about some of the things that we're buying. So there is responsibility on us, but then there's also responsibility on, you know, fishers and then also the larger corporations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I also thought it was really interesting. One of the things that stuck out super differently to me with this review is that you incorporated Twitter. I have not actually seen someone do that in a publication. I was actually really excited to see that. And so I kind of want to ask you and give you the opportunity to talk about why is it so important to incorporate social media aspects and how can you use that as real data and not just a social media platform?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really glad, first of all, that is something that kind of you enjoyed when you were reading the paper, because that was probably one of the reasons why I really, really wanted to include it. I wanted to write a research paper that kind of struck a chord with people our age, early career researchers. I didn't want to just write a paper that was just, you know, your standard boring paper that you just kind of switch off from in about 5 minutes. I wanted it to appeal to a younger audience. I wanted it to appeal to someone like me reading it. You know, I wanted people to enjoy that. And so incorporating Twitter into the paper was something that was really, really important for me. But another kind of one of the main reasons why it was used and was really sort of the start of the idea for the paper was that I was seeing shark entanglements and ray entanglements on Twitter. That's where I first started seeing them. And I was like, I was kind of scrolling through my Twitter because I'm fairly active on there. And I was scrolling through and I was seeing these entanglements. And I was thinking to myself, has anyone looked into this? Has anyone written about this in the scientific literature? And so it kind of, a little light bulb switched on in my head. And I was like, maybe I should kind of investigate this a little bit more. And you know, I kind of went into the scientific literature then and found out that no one was writing about it. And this was a knowledge gap. And it was a niche that was, you know, ready to be tapped into and ready to be written about. So, you know, social media, even at the start, was basically the inspiration for the paper. But then using it actually in the paper was kind of a really important supplementary tool. Now, I call it a supplementary tool because I think that is what it is. You cannot do or cannot write a paper purely from data that is collected entirely from social media. I just don't think you can do that. There's too many pitfalls. There's too many sort of sampling biases, which I'm sure we'll discuss. But as a sort of additional tool to something like a literature review or an experiment or something like that, it is a fantastic sort of center of information for you that can be used for a variety of conservation issues. You know, I was able to do it for shark and ray entanglement, but there's loads of things that you could do it for. You could do it for marine strandings. You could do it for, you know, kind of bycatch stuff. There's the list is endless of what it can be used for because the data is out there. It's there, you know, it's publicly available to everyone who registers to any of these social media sites. And it's not just Twitter as well. It's YouTube, it's Facebook, it's Instagram. It's all these social media sites are these mountains of information that are just waiting to be tapped into. And I think being used as this additional supplementary tool is a really, really cool thing. You know, we have to take into account the various, you know, pitfalls it has and various biases, but as an extra tool, it's fantastic.
I absolutely agree.
I mean, I definitely agree. I think, you know, we were going to ask you, which you basically answered was, you know, is social media a useful resource in determining things like population, determining entanglements, determining fish, like fisheries and bycatch and recreational catch. And I mean, if you think about it in terms of the U.S., you know, Florida is basically the recreational fishing capital of the world. And we write papers all the time about populations in Florida and bycatch in Florida. And there's this whole untapped kind of area in social media that has information that is definitely valuable. And you might not be able to write a full scientific paper on it, but as supplementary information is definitely useful because you basically just have more eyes out in the world that you can't go see all the time.
Yeah. And the great thing, I think, as well about social media is that you can get data in real time. It's instant, you know, it's literally at the click of a button and you've got that data there. And obviously you can get, you know, data from a long time ago. So I think the first recorded entanglement tweet that featured sort of, you know, a shark that was entangled was, I think it was all the way back in 2009. So I had to do some serious scrolling. Like after I typed in the keywords, I was like just there for days, just scrolling down. But, you know, it's real time data. And that's something that you can't get really anywhere else. You know, often you're relying on when you're looking at data sets, these are things that have sometimes been acquired over years. And it takes ages for them to, you know, get into a place where that data is available to be used. Whereas with social media, the three of us now could log on and start collecting data in the next 60 seconds. It's that, you know, available to us, which is, I think, an incredibly powerful tool. And I know social media gets a lot of stick, rightfully so in some cases. You know, it can often be the bane of a lot of people's lives and people spend far too much time on it, but it can also be used in positive ways as well. And I think if more of us use social media in a positive way, it wouldn't have such a bad name.
Yeah. I mean, that's the epitome of science communication too, right? I mean, we talk about using it as a tool for us to gather information, but vice versa, it's also a way, it's one of the only, Twitter especially is one of the best platforms I've seen scientists be able to communicate to the general public in a way that we don't necessarily have an opportunity to otherwise. So not only can we be gathering data from the general public about, is something working? Do they know about this? You can also start to see like, oh, this person like maybe is misinformed about this thing, or especially like organizations that maybe work around shark fishing. And hey, like here's how we can connect with these groups of people that maybe we otherwise wouldn't get the opportunity to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree wholeheartedly.
So one of the things I also want to touch base on for our listeners that might not be super familiar with some of this is, you know, what is entanglement? We just identified what the debris is that's in the ocean and animals get entangled, but is there like a technical definition for entanglement that we should define here for our listeners?
Yeah, so I mean, in the paper, we did it as elasmobranch entanglement, because I think there are a few sort of slightly different definitions, but generally it's the process by which we define it as a shark or a ray becomes entrapped or entwined in some form of human-made debris, whether that be, you know, nets or a plastic bag or something like that. So, and I think the main thing here is we had to make sure that we were differentiating between entanglement and bycatch, which are, although come under the same sort of umbrella, are two very, very different things. And that's really important to distinguish between both of those, because I think sometimes, you know, entanglement might get confused as bycatch, and sometimes bycatch might get confused as entanglement, and it's all a little bit blurred and a bit messy, which made it a little bit difficult to sort of go out there and search through the literature, because I'm sure there were accounts that we missed that were kind of recorded as bycatch, but perhaps were actually entanglement. And then, you know, vice versa, there may have been ones that were bycatch and instead of entanglement. You know, it's a difficult process. And I think if we start to make sure that people are aware of the difference between the two of them, then we can start kind of moving forwards in understanding the two issues as two separate issues.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just define for our listeners really quick, because did you actually say it? The what is bycatch and then what is entanglement, and how would you decipher those two things?
So I would use, for sort of bycatch and entanglement, I would use the two kind of like plug words, active and passive. So when you're thinking about bycatch, that's generally when a fisher has got some fishing equipment, they're in control of that fishing equipment, and they're actively going out and sort of, you know, catching fish. Various things then become entrapped in those nets, whether it be sharks or rays or, you know, turtles, whatever. And because those nets are active and those fishes still have control over that equipment, that would be classed as bycatch. When you're looking at entanglement, the key here is it's passive. So the fisher has lost operational control of that equipment, basically. So that equipment is gone. They're going to struggle to get it back. It's either, you know, it's broken off, it's been lost in a storm, or it's, you know, been abandoned because it's, you know, worn down and it's easier for them to just throw it overboard. And then that equipment then is passive. So it's passively sort of drifting around and thing, you know, animals are becoming entangled within that. So the two kind of key words there are active and passive. And when you're looking at sort of incidents and you're seeing things like this happening, if you can figure out, right, was that fishing net actively being used by the fisher at the time the animal was caught in it? If it was, bycatch. If that net had become kind of detached and, you know, the fisher was nowhere to be seen, it's passive, and that's entanglement. That's the kind of broadest way I would probably separate the two issues. But you can see there how there could potentially be confusion between them both.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could see how, I think you mentioned that in your review, there definitely probably were some papers or instances that you missed. And especially if the definitions aren't as clear cut as you just put them, if people have varying definitions of what these two words might mean, then you could have looked at a paper where they said bycatch, but it was actually entanglement. And if there's so many different kinds of papers out there doing that, then it's hard to figure out and actually read through all of those and then decide for yourself which one was entanglement and which one was bycatch. So I like that you kind of noted that.
And there were also as well, Imani, there were papers that we had to exclude because we couldn't decipher. So it was a case of, you know, we'd see these papers and we were like, I just don't know if this is actually entanglement or it's bycatch. And so, you know, to be as rigorous as possible to make sure that we weren't getting kind of false data, we just had to exclude them. So I am 100% sure that there were incidents that were missed in this process, in this review. And that's unfortunately unavoidable.
Yeah. And I mean, you're pointing out an important thing in science in general, which is that even as we publish all these papers, there's always going to be what ifs. What if I miss something? What if I'm not covering something fully? There's always things that we aren't seeing, which is why in most scientific papers, there's usually a couple sentences on what could have made this better. What might we have missed? What is this like gray area in this paper that we haven't yet discussed, but could have potentially helped the paper? Which I think is really important for our listeners to understand, because science is just the process of trying to understand things. And that process is not always perfect.
Yeah. And for our listeners that might not actually understand why it even matters to make those distinctions between bycatch and entanglement, I think it's just important to at least acknowledge, you know, we need this data so that we can have accurate reports on what are real issues in the ocean, because that can affect policy, right? Because if we lump entanglement and bycatch in one big category, we might be trying to address a problem that isn't there, isn't being addressed appropriately. Bycatch is a big problem, and we need to make sure to fix that in a certain way. And fixing bycatch is a very different approach than trying to fix entanglement issues. So that's why we're kind of getting all, you know, caught up in this terminology. It's important to be able to distinguish those things so that we can make sure to move forward as best as possible to address the problems appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not just kind of us being picky scientists and being like, we want to create different definitions for various different words. No, we like, we need to really make sure we're getting this right.
Yeah, it's super important. And You mentioned in your review that there aren't actually that many papers on entanglement itself in comparison to other large research fields in shark science. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, why do you think that is? Could it be that people are talking about bycatch, but it's actually entanglement? Like there's all these gray areas, you know? And so I was curious as to, are there just not people studying it? Is it really hard to study? What is the reason for this kind of like discrepancy in the amount of published papers?
I think it's probably a mix of loads of different things. I think one of the main reasons probably why people aren't writing about it is because it's not actually happening in huge levels that we know of, right? So in the paper, we do mention that we think it's happening at far higher levels than what it currently is, but it's still probably not happening at the numbers of, you know, kind of what bycatch levels are. So, you know, when things are happening at greater levels, you can really, and people are seeing it more and more, there's going to be more writing on that and people are going to focus on those issues. But I think the important thing was, you know, what we wrote about in the paper was that, you know, we need to look into this more because we do think it's happening at greater levels than it currently is. And that's also kind of part of the reason why we used Twitter as well to supplement that data, because we were seeing on Twitter, you know, there were more reports from 2009 to 2019 on Twitter than in the last 80 years in the scientific literature. So, and you know, not only that, but there were sharks appearing on Twitter as entangled that weren't recorded as entangled in the literature. Whale sharks, for example, there are no currently recorded entanglements for whale sharks in the scientific literature. They're just not there. It's not been written about, but it's happening. And we can see that from Twitter. And that's what Twitter helped us say, was that, look, this issue, okay, it's probably not at the levels of, you know, overfishing and bycatch in terms of shark mortality, but it's definitely happening at way higher levels than we think it is. Okay, it still might be an animal welfare issue as opposed to sort of having these wide-ranging conservation concerns, but it's still happening. And that, you know, Twitter was able to really help us kind of push that message forwards, right? Because we were finding animals that weren't recorded as entangled in the literature, but they are. And yeah. I think that was a really kind of interesting and cool thing that we were able to sort of spoon into the paper.
I thought that was one of the most incredible points of the paper, is just showing how much is not always recorded in scientific literature. We're always trying to prove things, and you need to publish it to make sure that it's actually been peer reviewed and accepted by the scientific community. But when things are actually factually happening in real time that aren't, we're not catching up to and recording, I just think that was such an incredible point. And again, just reiterating how these social media encounters can really support science. And I, as soon as I read that part about whale sharks in your paper, I immediately was like, oh, I've seen that video. I'm sure a lot of people have seen the video of the scuba divers trying to keep up with the whale shark and cut off the ghost net that was wrapped around its gills. So like, as immediately as I read that, I was like, oh yeah, I've seen that video. And that is important to make sure we capture in the science literature.
20 recorded whale shark entanglements on Twitter. None in the scientific literature. 20.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it doesn't sound a lot, but when you think there's none in the scientific literature, you're like, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
Why are people not writing about this?
And people aren't always reporting it, is the other thing. And that was another big issue that you brought up in the paper, is that a lot of things are just going unreported. You found 20 encounters that people happen to have a social media account, they happen to have access to Wi-Fi, and they decided to upload that encounter on Twitter. A lot of people are not doing that might have that encounter engagement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I was just going to say, I think that this whole bit that we're talking about of how it's on Twitter, but it's not in the literature. There's a really big reason why scientists don't say, oh, we proved this, or this is definitely happening, or this is definitely not happening. Because if you just read the literature review, then your point of view is whale sharks are never getting entangled. But then if you go to Twitter, there you're like, oh, whale sharks are definitely getting entangled. And so there's a reason why, like, yeah, we publish all these papers and they go through like all these crazy reviews, and we try to be as non-biased as possible when we publish them. But there's a very large reason why we don't ever explicitly say this is happening, this is not happening. And it's for the reason that you're stating right now.
Yeah, definitely.
In your results, right, in the literature review, it basically stated that the Pacific is where most of the entanglements are happening. And then when you went to Twitter, it was like, oh, the Atlantic is where most of the entanglements are happening. And so my question was, you know, where is plastic pollution considered to be the greatest? Because you also talk about gyres and how ocean currents can kind of move all of this plastic pollution, ghost fishing gear that's just floating in the water column to different areas. I think most of our listeners probably know what the like giant Pacific garbage patch is. And that's a gyre. Like that is all these currents connecting with each other and creating this island of plastic that sits and floats there because the currents are pushing it. So I kind of just wanted to talk about for our readers who don't know what gyres are, who maybe don't understand how ocean currents work, if you could kind of just explain where you saw plastic pollution to be the highest and why that might be.
So I think, first of all, obviously there's discrepancies there. You know, on Twitter, it's the Atlantic, and in the literature, it was the Pacific. And so kind of looking into those discrepancies, first of all, from the literature in the Pacific Ocean, you're thinking, okay, right, there's potentially here some scientific sampling bias, right? So generally, wealthier Western nations will do more research on topics, right? So you're thinking there, okay, the Pacific Ocean, you're looking at the West Coast of America, there's probably a lot of research coming out of the West Coast of America that's based around the Pacific Ocean. So I think there's potentially a scientific sampling bias. And we do mention that in the paper that you know, generally the wealthier nations are doing more research. And so you're going to get more data from that area. But then when you look at Twitter with the Atlantic Ocean coming up as the, you know, the hot spot of plastic pollution, that's probably, again, another bias. And that one is probably more to do with a sampling bias from Twitter. So our timelines on Twitter and the things that we can find are generally going to be written in English, right? So that's what we were kind of looking for. We were using keywords, you know, in English, and that's going to return sort of English-speaking nations. So the tweets were kind of coming from, again, America, you know, the East Coast of America there, down into sort of Florida. And then you're looking at stuff from the UK, again, English-speaking. So there's, another bias, you know, from Twitter this time, that's probably meaning we're not getting results from some of the other locations because they're not cropping up in English.
Did you do any searches in a different language?
We didn't, no. And that's something that I think would have been a really, really cool thing to do and could be something that we could try and do in the future, you know, is by taking on board someone who can speak another language. For example, you know, starting to look east, you know, towards India and Indonesia and those kind of places, then we might potentially start getting reports from there. I mean, especially on from, you know, kind of using Twitter. So there's lots of different little biases here in terms of, you know, finding out where is the place that has the most plastic pollution. All the ocean basins have their own garbage patch, basically. And that's, you know, kind of what Amani was saying there about ocean currents and gyres. Basically, they're various ocean currents that kind of are manipulated by wind and the rotation of the earth. And that means that currents kind of go round in circles, big circles, very, very big circles. That's the kind of simplest way I think I can put it. But each ocean has its own gyre and therefore has its own garbage patch. And it's very, very difficult to tell kind of which one has the most. There's probably large amounts in every single ocean basin, realistically. I know the one we hear about the most is obviously the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, but the Atlantic Ocean will have one, the southern, you know, northern and southern. There will be two kind of gyres there that both have garbage patches. The Indian Ocean will have one, and the Pacific Ocean will probably have another two as well. So, you know, it's very, very difficult, I think, to say, okay, well, this ocean basin has the most plastic, because it's such a difficult thing to sort of estimate, because that's what you can only estimate it. You can only estimate because there's no way you can go out there and count every single piece of plastic that's in the Pacific Ocean. It's such a huge place.
Right. You have to scale it in some way, which also has its own biases.
Yeah. So I kind of want to bring us a little bit around to talk about more about the results of the paper. Something that I found really interesting was you talk about the characteristics of some of the shark families that you see that have the highest entanglement risk. So I'm wondering if you could kind of summarize that for our readers so that we can talk a little bit about it, because I think the three of us can probably agree that most of the species that you see in the media are like five that we can all count on our hands, and they all have similar characteristics to each other. And so I thought it was really interesting kind of reading about the different characteristics that sharks may or may not have that leads to them having a higher entanglement risk.
Yeah. So we kind of hypothesized three primary drivers of entanglement. So the first is habitat. The second is sort of migratory nature. And then the third is morphology or body form. So kind of going through them one by one. When you look at habitat, one of these species or, you know, types of species that we found commonly entangled were demersal shark species. So these are sharks that sort of live along the bottom of the ocean. They're sort of feeding along the bottom. Now, these are sharks, for example, like lesser spotted dogfish, which we get really commonly here in the UK, you know, spiny dogfish, other sort of demersal type sharks. Now, that habitat that they live in potentially predisposes them to entanglement, because as we mentioned before, with the ghost fishing gear, as it's sort of indiscriminately catching these organisms as it's floating around, it gets heavier and heavier and eventually sinks to the bottom. And that's exactly where these sharks live. And what it's basically doing is, as it sinks and it's got all these organisms in it, it's basically a massive dinner bell to any, you know, sharks that are nearby and other scavengers. You know, you get crustaceans generally aggregate all over these nets, sort of feeding on the decaying debris and decaying organisms, sorry, inside this debris. And that's prey species for these demersal sharks. So what they're doing potentially, you know, obviously we don't know this for sure, we're just hypothesizing, but they're coming over to these sunken bits of ghost net and finding themselves entangled. And that's, you know, a real issue for those type of species, these species that live along the bottom. Moving onwards, you're looking at sort of migratory species. So another kind of big family of sharks that we were finding were getting entangled quite a lot was the Carcharhinid family of sharks. And lots of these are sort of pelagic shark species that travel sort of, you know, hundreds, maybe even thousands of kilometers, you know, huge distances. And they're traveling these massive distances and encountering these plastic sort of, you know, garbage patches in these oceans because they're traveling these huge distances. And because of those movements that they're making, the chance of them encountering that debris is greater than, for example, a shark species that might be more resident on a reef, for example. So their chance encounters are, you know, happening at higher rates, and that could mean they're getting entangled more. We know that sharks are super inquisitive, super curious, love to test things out in their environment, and bits of debris are novel things for a shark and its environment. And that could be initially the way that these sharks are first becoming entangled. Their curious nature as they're, you know, traveling these large distances, you know, up comes a bit of debris. They think, this could be a meal. I'm gonna try and bite this. And in that process, they become entangled. So, you know, that's the kind of the second one. And then the third one, which was morphology or body shape. So looking at it from a kind of really high level, first of all, your sharks and your rays are obviously very, very different in their shape. So rays are dorsoventrally flattened. Sharks sort of have that more fusiform body shape, like a torpedo. And that potentially, we were finding significantly more entanglement reports in sharks than we were rays. Now, that could be a reason why, is because these sharks, their body shape is predisposing them potentially to get entangled in this debris. Then when you look a little bit further down into certain species, so for example, manta rays with their cephalic fins on the front of their sort of faces, these sort of weird appendages that kind of stick out are getting entangled more because of just the way that they're designed. The same with sawfish with that really elongated rostrum and the teeth coming out either side.
It's asking to get
that
entangled.
Is an appendage. Exactly, you know, that is an appendage that becomes so easily entwined in things like monofilament line. You know, these sort of body features potentially are predisposing them already to getting caught in debris. So those were the kind of what we hypothesized to be the three primary drivers. There could be other reasons, but those were the ones that we thought potentially were the kind of main drivers of entanglement within elasmobranchs.
I liked this part of paper one because I am like very into morphology. But also because I think for the average person, thinking about how their shape might predispose them to entanglement is not like the first thing that pops into your head. And it also kind of forces you to think about how your actions might be affecting other species more than others for something that isn't their fault. Like, it's not their fault that they're shaped the way that they are. It's not their fault that they have hooks hanging off their face. And I just thought that was really interesting because I'd also never really considered how body shape could kind of predispose you to things like becoming entangled and not being able to get out of it easily. In the same way that like a nurse shark might be able to be entangled, but they can keep living because they can buccal pump. Whereas, you know, a great hammerhead is a ram ventilator. And if they get stuck and they can't keep swimming, like that is an issue and they will likely die.
Exactly that.
Yeah, and for listeners that maybe don't know, like not every shark species has to swim to breathe, but the hammerhead is one of those, which means they're an obligate ram ventilator, so they have to be swimming to breathe. And I just think it's also interesting because technology has continued to get so much better, and some of the coolest scientific kind of adaptations to help these animals prevent them from getting entangled has been these really cool ways of modifying our fishing gear so that animals that are predisposed to getting entangled, like sea turtles and sharks that we see a lot in the literature, maybe won't get entangled because we've modified just the way that we make our nets, which is something that I think we need to really think about and continue to invest in, because that's definitely really important, especially in terms of bycatch, because I know we're talking about entanglement here today, but bycatch is by far like the biggest threat to sharks. And that's what we really need to think about, is how do we get the target thing that we want to fish without killing all these other species by mistake? And we're not making use of that animal. It'd be one thing if we were targeting a shark and we were making use of it and feeding our families with it. It's another thing when it just dies and we toss it over the side of the boat and we can't make use of that animal. So those kind of modifications are super important as we think about, why is that animal predisposed to getting entangled? How do we prevent it from happening again? And we get some of the coolest innovations from that.
Yeah, I think as well, you know, one of the really unfortunate things about swordfish specifically, they're already so threatened. You know, these are species that are on the brink, right? They're probably, I'm pretty sure they're the most threatened family of sharks.
Yeah. I mean, the Endangered Species Act was basically made for them. So,
yeah,
exactly. And that's one of the really unfortunate things, is that, you know, these sharks are already threatened by so many different anthropogenic factors. And on top of this, they're also getting entangled in debris that's, you know, from humans. So, you know, that body shape has predisposed them. And it's just so unfortunate that they're already threatened and already on the brink. And, it, you know, that's why if we can try and limit the negative impacts on a species like the swordfish, that's how we're going to save them. You know, if we can prevent, you know, a few swordfish from being entangled in human-based debris, then that's a good thing. Obviously, we need to sort out the main issues based around, you know, the reasons that swordfish are declining, which is, again, bycatch. But if we can save, you know, save a few from being, passively entangled as well, that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
That is a good thing and something we need to do.
Right. And I mean, I think this is a good lead into our next question, which is, what can the average person do to help mitigate and hopefully lessen the amount of entanglement and plastic pollution overall in the ocean? You know, for the people who are listening to this, they're probably thinking, like, what can I do? What can we as normal people who maybe aren't even interacting with the ocean that much, what can we do to kind of help mitigate this problem?
I think it can be quite a daunting thing initially, because you look at a paper like this and you think, right, okay, well, a lot of it's fishing-based stuff. You know, how am I going to do anything about that? But there are lots of little personal things that we can do. So we've mentioned the fact that land-based debris is entangling sharks and rays. You know, that's things like the rings on the six-pack can of beer, plastic bags. I didn't mention it earlier, but a shark was entangled in a snapback cap through the sort of, you know, little hole in the back. Shark had managed to get his head through that and that had choked it and it died. Wow. You know, there's these are human items. They are so human and used by us all the time. So there's loads and loads of things that we can do on a personal level, you know, really, really think about what things we're buying. You know, if you can reduce the amount of plastic that you do use, that's a good thing. It's a good thing from, you know, a moral perspective for yourself. It's a really good thing to do. If you can think about that, try and reduce that overall amount that you're using. And then if you do have to use plastic, try and recycle it. I know there are problems with recycling. I know that, you know, once you put that in the recycling, you don't really know actually what happens to it.
That's a whole other podcast.
It's a whole other podcast. Exactly. We have not got time to talk about that. But if you know, you can do lots of different things. I think the main one would be to reduce your overall kind of, I don't want to say consumption of plastic because we're not eating it, but use of plastic. But then other little things, going and doing a beach clean, you know, it's such a simple, easy thing to do that can make a little bit of a difference. But then finally with it, I would say really, really try and lobby the people in power, governments, corporations, you know, to actually start doing something about it, because they're the ones that are going to actually be able to make the policy change that has an effect here. And if you start lobbying those people in power, if enough people start doing it, and then you start voting with your feet on issues like this, things will change. It will change. It will get better. But we've got to vote with our feet. We have to lobby these people.
I think I just want to like really emphasize that point, because I think so many people want to blame groups of people, like individual fishers, for example. I think people might listen to this podcast and immediately jump on board to like, fishers are evil. We need to stop fishing any fish out of the ocean, which is really not the case. We can fish in sustainable ways that can support our economy, that can support our local fishers, and can support the fish populations that we rely on. And it's not about putting pressure on those individuals. It's about putting pressure on the corporations and the larger groups of people that can actually influence change, monetize, and make it a priority to modify our fishing gear, make it a priority to assess a lot of these threats to the animals that we're relying on. I absolutely agree. Mm-hmm. And I just really want to drive that home because I think it's such an important point.
100%. We should not be blaming fishers at all. You know, we need to start, I think, you know, looking at the fishing side of things, if we can start providing incentives for fishers to perhaps, you know, go out and collect lost gear or dispose of their gear in ways that isn't going to be sort of harmful for the environment, providing fishers with incentives to do that is going to help the issue. Definitely. These people love the ocean just as much as we do and depend on the ocean, you know, for their livelihoods. They want to see a healthy ocean just as much as we do. They're not the villains of this story. The real villains of the story are the large corporations and the governments of the world. They are the villains.
Yes. I feel like they're so like, take down capitalism whenever I talk about like anything like this, because I get like so, it just like hits a very like emotional like strand for me when people go blaming fishers and others who are, I guess, sure, contributing, but like that is their livelihood. And we can't blame them for their livelihood and then not address why they have to do what they're doing or who's in charge of what they're doing. And I'm so happy that we are like taking the time to say this. We say this a lot on our podcast, and it does not remotely bother me that like every other episode we're saying this.
No, it's such an important point. And I think, we can't talk about it enough.
Yeah.
But I do want to bring it back to you, Christian. You have been doing a ton of really cool work, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about some of that work, including your really cool YouTube channel where you're interpreting a lot of these issues to listeners as well, called Shark Bites. So could you tell us a little bit about that work, that line of work that you do?
Yeah. So, I mean, Shark Bites kind of came about, I think I started it last September, but the idea and the sort of the seeds that were sown came a little bit before that. So I started posting on Twitter these sort of little short clips of me in my back garden, generally talking about shark species that we get here in the UK for 60 seconds. It was called 60 Second Shark Science. And people seem to really enjoy it, and they really like the videos. And, you know, they didn't go crazy, but people were enjoying the content. And it got me thinking. I was like, I want to do more of this. How can I talk about sharks more? Because this is what I love doing. I love talking about sharks. And generally, people love listening about sharks. And it's, you know, something that's really, really important. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I could just start a YouTube channel about sharks. And I had a little look on YouTube and I couldn't find anything out there that, you know, a channel purely dedicated to, you know, content entirely about sharks and, you know, shark news and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, I had a little brainstorm and thought to myself, I was like, right, okay, let's see what we can do with this. And, you know, it's Shark Bites for me is, you know, a bit of a hobby, but for a lot of people these days, they're getting something out of it that's really cool. They're learning, but they're also having fun at the same time. And I think often, because sort of the age range for people who watch Shark Bites, it's the sort of the main demographic, it's kind of between 16 and 25-ish. That's that sort of demographic. And people of that age generally, I mean, maybe the slightly, you know, younger age of that spectrum, they want to learn, but they don't want to be told that they're learning, right?
It's so true.
they just want to engage with, you know, watch content. And with Shark Bites, it's content there that's just sort of, a broad range of content, but people are learning that. It's filled with various different facts about sharks and, you know, everything is kind of coming at them, but subtly. And that's something that I really, really enjoyed doing is kind of like slipping in just little bits of shark knowledge here or there, but at the same time, kind of just maintaining this stream of content for them. So, for example, I mean, I don't know if you guys subscribe to Shark Bites, but
I just
one
did.
Of the... yes, another subscriber. but one of the sections of the channel, we do shark movie commentaries. So
oh, cool.
Sharks in cinema and sharks in film is a massive thing. People love sharks on the big screen. Obviously, we've got so many shark movies from the past that have been huge blockbusters. You know, you go straight to Jaws, Deep Blue Sea. You know, there's loads and loads of
Sharknado.
Stuff. And so on the channel, Sharknado, exactly. There's so many different kind of cool shark films that are sort of, you know, weird in their own little way. But on the channel, we kind of take these shark movies and we basically it's just sort of me in the bottom right hand corner of the screen and there's clips from the movie. It's not the full movie. They're sort of broken down into sort of 10 to 15 minute episodes. But we go through the movie and we kind of look at the sort of things that they're getting right about sharks and maybe things that they're definitely getting wrong. And we're kind of, you know, looking at all these cool different things. And I would say probably that's the most popular part of the channel. People are really, really enjoying that.
I was just
going to
say, that is so needed. That is so necessary. I'm so glad you're doing that.
And that's the thing. They're kind of, they're also a little bit funny.
Right. They got to be kitschy.
There's a bit of humor in there. There's also, you know, learning in there, there's facts about sharks and there's, you know, things that you look at and you point out and you're like, this is ridiculous. How they've got away with this, I will never know. But, you know, those kind of things, people are really enjoying that content. I mean, that's one little section of the channel. We look at so many other things, viral videos, new research papers, sharks that are kind of cropping up in the news. There is literally something for everyone on that channel. If you like sharks and you want to kind of learn more about sharks or just watch shark content, Shark Bites is the channel for you because there is something for everyone there.
Awesome. I love that we're doing like a Shark Bites Sharkpedia crossover right now.
Yeah, we are.
Yes. It's a great collaboration. I love it.
Hopefully not the last.
Yeah. So before we close the episode, we're going to ask you our favorite question, which is, what is your favorite field story? And this does not have to be, you know, from this paper. This could just be any field story that you've had that you think is one of your, you know, top three favorites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a bit of a think about this. It's such a difficult question, actually. It's a really, really difficult question. But the one I'm going to go for is we're going back a few years. So we're going back to when I was an undergraduate here in the UK at the University of Exeter. And I was really, really fortunate enough to be able to do my dissertation on whale sharks. So in the summer before my final year, I flew over to the Philippines and I was there for about 3.5 months. And it was at a place called Oslob in the Philippines. And you may have heard of it before. It's one of the only, I'm pretty sure it might be the only provisioning site for whale sharks in the world. So basically that means that they feed the whale sharks and it kind of lures them in for the tourists, basically. And it's become somewhat of a bit of a tourist trap. There's a lot more restrictions now, I think. Initially, it was just a bit of a free-for-all and was absolutely crazy. But it's become a little bit more restrictive. But the organization that I was working with there was basically trying to sort of be flies on the wall and collect data on the sharks, see if there are any sort of behavioral impacts on them. You know, is this provisioning, you know, changing the way that they live their mm-hmm. lives, all this kind of stuff. So I was a researcher there for, you know, 3.5 months or so, and I was collecting data for my undergraduate dissertation. And when you're there for that period of time, the same sharks generally show up every single day. And so you start to learn via the spot mm-hmm. patterns or maybe certain markings, which individuals are which. So you can almost immediately, you look at the spot patterns or look at, you know, a slight kind of kink in the tail or something, you can tell which individual shark that is. So they were all numbered. So immediately, well, after a kind of a month or so of doing it, you recognize pretty quickly, this is shark number 6, or this is shark number 25. You know, you see them every day pretty much, and you're like, okay, this one. And that means that you start to learn that these sharks have different personalities, right? So there are various things that certain sharks will do, and you start to see this personality come out, and you almost, it's a bit of a strange thing to say, but you get to know individual sharks and what they like doing and this kind of stuff. So my kind of strange field story is basically just sort of learning the different personalities of all these sharks. So for example, shark number 6, who I just mentioned a second ago, sticks in my mind every time because he was a bit of a pain, to be honest. So shark number 6 liked to ram into you. It's a really quite a strange thing.
And those are, you know, not it's, small it's kind animals.
They are not small animals, and it's pretty much, I would describe it as being hit by a slow-moving bus. And so shark number six decided that he was going to do everything in his power to just bump you. None of the other sharks liked to do this. They all had weird personalities. So for example, shark number 78 or something loved eating bubbles, right? Scuba diver bubbles, loved eating it. Literally would follow some of the divers around just eating their bubbles, obsessed with it. Didn't care about the provisioning food, loved the bubbles. So, you know, they've all got these different personalities, but shark number 6 was a bumper. Oh, so he liked to just come in and just whack you. Now, the number of times that I got hit by shark number 6 was ridiculous. And there was one time in particular. So at the end of the sort of session, so the sharks are fed from about 6 o'clock in the morning till noon. And then at noon, the fishermen go in and the sharks slowly start to sort of filter away and leave the area. Now, we would put someone in the water between noon and 1 o'clock to basically just sort of swim around the interaction area, recording any sharks that were still there. And generally, pretty much, there's no sharks. They leave very, very quickly after the food goes, but not number 6. Number 6 liked to stick around for a little bit. So there was one particular session in this sort of noon to one session that I got put in the water. And I'm swimming around and I haven't seen a shark for about 25 minutes. And basically all I'm doing is I'm just sort of swimming around. I'm free diving, kind of practicing my breath holds, that kind of stuff, going down, seeing how far I can go and that kind of stuff. And on one particular breath hold, I've decided to kind of go down maybe about, I don't know, 10 meters or so. And I've got to the bottom-ish, the sort of sandbank. and I'm like, okay, my breath is starting to go a little bit. I'm going to head back to the surface. And I turn around and who is maybe 10 centimeters from my face? Shark number 6. He's right there. Honestly, I have never jumped or been frightened by an animal as much as I was on that case. Shark number 6 is there and he clatters into me, head first, bang, straight into me. And I'm sort of already needing breath. I've just been whacked by a 6-meter whale shark, right? At about 10 meters down. He's just having the best time. He's loving it. He's absolutely loving it. And shark number 6 used to do this in every session, pretty much every noon to one session. He'd go around stalking the kind of, you know, the person who was in the water at that point, because people would say the same thing. He, you know, oh, number 6 is after me again today. And I was like, oh, classic number 6.
Yeah.
And he would just continually just bat, 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 bosh you. So that's my sort of mildly crazy field story. I'm probably one of the very few people in the world to have been regularly bumped by a 6-meter whale shark.
Yeah. And like, I mean, it's important to make the distinction that this is not a shark that eats meat. Like, yeah. This is a shark. Yeah, exactly. And so it's honestly, it's so funny that like this shark has decided that this is what fun is. And you can all just deal with it as I continuously bump into you and or stalk you while you're swimming.
I mean,
and you can do nothing about
it. Was the wind knocked out of you? Like, were you just like, oh, like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that wasn't the only time that number 6 knocked into me. There was another time where I've kind of free dived down and I'm starting going up. And there were times in the sort of, you know, mid-morning sessions where we might have 30 whale sharks in the space of an area no bigger than a football field. So it's chaotic. Sharks are kind of going
amazing
everywhere. And you sort of have to, as you're coming back up to the, you know, the surface from a, you know, a duck dive down, you're looking around because you're like, okay, I've got to sort of avoid this shark this way and I've got to go this way. Number 6, he sees you doing that. He sees you doing that. And there's one occasion he's hit me hard, really hard on the side. And I've got to the surface and he's literally made my right arm and right leg numb, like dead.
Oh my gosh. Completely
killed my arm. And so I'm kind of at the surface of the water, treading water with my fins on, without the use of my right arm and right leg. And I've kind of just had to like sort of grab onto one of the fishermen's sort of little canoe things to be like, can I just hang here for a second? Number 6 has just smacked me and I can't feel my arms and legs.
Oh my gosh. I feel like I just like see this like cartoon sequence happening. Like it'd be such a funny tattoo to have you like getting knocked over free diving by a whale shark. That's number 6.
Yeah, but I'll never forget him though. That's the thing, you know, I will never, ever forget that shark. And it was really, really amazing because you did start to learn the personalities of these sharks. And I think that's quite an incredible thing, is when you spend, you know, hours and hours in the water with these animals, they really, really do have different characteristics.
Sharks have personalities, everybody. Sharks have personalities.
Exactly. 100%, you know, some are bold, some are shy, some like to have fun by smacking into you. Like these are individuals. And that's, you know, I feel so, so fortunate to have been able to experience that with a wild animal.
Yeah, no kidding.
So cool.
Thank you so much. That did not disappoint at all. And I just want to make sure our listeners know where to follow you exactly before we close this out. So where should they follow you? Where can they learn more about some of the work that you're doing?
So my main kind of use of social media, you guessed it, it's Twitter. And you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @KJParton. I'm usually tweeting about sharky things, lots of the entanglement stuff. We're at the moment, I have a master's student who's writing up a follow-up paper. So there's lots of stuff going on there. And then also come and subscribe to Shark Bites on YouTube. That's Bites, B-Y-T-E-S. A little clever little pun on the name there. But yeah, come and subscribe to Shark Bites. I'd love to have you on the channel, all of you on the channel, and come and join the discussions that we have in the comments sections of the videos. The start of season 3 should be coming out pretty soon. I'm kind of in the off season at the moment, but feel free to go and check out seasons 1, season 2. You know, there's loads of content there already for you. You know, come and engage with it. I'd love to have you across on the channel.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm going to go subscribe right now. All right. Well, thank you so much, Christian. And thanks, Sharkies. And until next time,
swim you later.